Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I got my fancy green screen working here. Don Moeller's got his Rofo coffee working. All of our WNST and Baltimore Positive stuff brought to you by our friends at Fahley's. And I want to give a shout out to El Guapo. I made the mistake of holding the beer growler because it had the logo on it and then giving it back to the bartender when I was at El Guapo. I made the mistake of eating all of the burritos, so I can't show it to you. I do have some chips left over in the bag, though, with some salsa. El Guapo was wonderful. Don knows all about that, the chicken and waffles at State Fair. Also, shout out to Fadley's. I have been inspired by the Fadley's crab cake to go on search of crab cake's future. I'm going to be telling you more about that here at Baltimore Positive. I might even let Moeller go on some of these things. We might even explore East Baltimore and Harford County and Carroll County a little bit with the former Baltimore County executive. Don, I know we've been working up the old election. We got a new election and we got current issues and all sorts of stuff. You have kept us very, very busy. And I know our next guest is one of our favorite defending champions here.
Yeah, without a doubt, a Baltimore Positive veteran, one of the real bright lights in the legislature. It's our pleasure to welcome the delegate from the 46th, Brooke Learman. Brooke, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to start my with you gentlemen. So thanks for having me on this morning.
I'll get the Springsteen poster. You know, I would start with that, and that's political unto itself. But I'll let you know, my wife and I walked miles in 46 on Wednesday evening when it was 50-something degrees when it started. A beautiful, glorious walk through your part of the world. So there, have at it.
It is a beautiful part of the world and a beautiful part of Maryland. And I love, you know, it's an honor representing it, and my family and I love living there. So it is a great place to be.
Not too hilly, although we did go up Highland Avenue. And it, you know,
I was going to say, it can. There are parts of it where I promise it's hilly, and I've done the door knocking and, you know, up. And then you get to the top and you see this, you're rewarded by an amazing view of Domino Sugar and the harbor and the port. And
I was rewarded with a stout at the Chaucer, so everything worked out.
There you go.
Nestor, before I get into trouble with our sponsors and our listeners, I'll do my little John Meacham thing here. Full disclosure, I do want to let people know that I've come out publicly and supported Brooke's run for controller. I think she's the right person for the right time. So I want to disclose that. I've been on a host committee, so I don't want people to think we're trying to hide anything. I am a supporter of Brooke Learman for controller of the state of Maryland.
I think we can still ask the tough questions.
That's why I like it. I love being on here and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thanks. Brooke, I think that, you know, folks, certainly in the Baltimore area, are growing increasingly familiar with you. But folks around the state, and we have listeners around the state, may not know a whole lot about you or your background. So fill the folks in. Tell them who Brooke Learman is, how she got to where she is, and how she came to care so much about public service.
Sure. Well, you know, I was raised to believe in the power of public service to make a positive difference in people's lives. So certainly credit my upbringing with that. But, you know, I'm a civil rights and disability rights attorney. And I spent, you know, many years, you know, from college to I was born in D.C., raised in Montgomery County, graduated from Walt Whitman High School, and, you know, settled in Baltimore with my husband after law school, and have been thrilled to be able to work at a great disability rights and civil rights law firm. And then, you know, I saw a problem. I was really frustrated by lack of good public transit to get me and other people to work in Baltimore. We were looking at schools in Baltimore for our child, and, you know, all of the water fountains said, don't drink the water because of lead in the pipes. And I was representing community groups around the city as pro bono counsel in front of the liquor board, doing all sorts of different work with them. And I just kept getting frustrated on their behalf because government was really working against our communities and not with us. And so was inspired to run for office. So, you know, saw a problem, threw my hat in the ring, knocked on, you know, 14,000 doors, worked with people from around the district and the city, and was excited to be elected delegate in 2014. And so I've been serving in the General Assembly since then. I spent 5 years on the Appropriations Committee, working on our state's budget, where I, you know, my eyes were open to the processes of government. And now I'm delighted to serve in a leadership role on the Environment Transportation Committee, where we also tackle ethics and housing and natural resources issues. And was just named chair of our Oversight Committee on Pensions. So love being able to represent the fight in 46 and work at both the community level to really dig in and help meet the needs of our residents, but also pass important legislation at the statewide level too.
I want to ask you from the beginning, the first thing you said about yourself was civil rights, like I literally, and I'm thinking, you know, at this point, I'm 52 now. At 32 on the radio, I probably wouldn't have been discussing that so much. Certainly your pathway to doing all this in the representation, where does the young person in you, where does the 12-year-old girl in you first hear about civil rights to want to be a civil rights? What put you on that pathway from the way you grew up?
Sure. I mean, I think my parents did I grew up in a very integrated neighborhood in Washington, D.C. Actually, my next door neighbors were probably one of the first interracial married couples in D.C. They were an older couple who looked after us a lot. They were Howard University professors. But, you know, from an early age, I was taught a lot about the, you know, how things just, we have to fight to make sure that people have a fair shot and that our laws are applied equally and equitably. And I studied, you know, labor and labor unions a lot in law school and worked with a labor law professor, and ultimately decided that I wanted to go to a firm where I was representing people who were not being well represented and who the laws were not being applied to fairly and who were the underdogs, right? Even before I went to law school, I worked on political campaigns, and I worked for a man named Paul Wellstone when he ran for re-election in 2002 to the U.S. Senate. And he used to say, you know, we all do better when we all do better. And that's sort of a fundamental belief of mine, is that we can't just be looking out for ourselves because we're all inextricably linked somehow. And so I was fortunate enough to land at a law firm, Brown, Goldstein & Levy, where, you know, we've done housing discrimination cases. I represent a lot of low-wage workers who are not being paid fairly or not being paid overtime or not even the minimum wage. Sometimes we've represented wrongfully convicted individuals who, you know, serve time that they shouldn't have. So I've had the pleasure of working in a lot of different capacities at my law firm, and I represent people with disabilities all over the country who are not being given a fair shake and who the ADA is supposed to be protecting, but for whatever reason, people aren't applying it. So it's been a real honor to represent these folks and to help be their champion in a court of law. But I also decided that I want to be able to do that and pass laws to make sure that our government is working with people and we have the tools to make sure that we're righting many of the past wrongs, past and ongoing wrongs.
Brooke, I have to, Nestor, that was a great question, because, and we jump all over the place here, and we'll get into the controller's race in a little while. I want to start with the General Assembly, but I do have to ask you about something that I read recently, and I turned to my wife and I said, are we still going to do this? And it was a comment when it was talking about potential candidates for the controller's office. And I'm going to paraphrase, but the gist of one of the sentences was, well, Brooke's really talented and she's, you know, she's doing well in Annapolis, but you know, sometimes people say she's a little ambitious, a little too fast, a little too ambitious. And I thought, when I just listened to you talk and what
I think the phrase was uber ambitious.
Uber ambitious. And I did. I turned to my wife and I said, somehow I don't think that if Brooke were a 50-year-old white guy, we would be describing her as uber ambitious. Just react to that when you read it, because I thought, this is really strange. It's 2021 and we're describing this individual.
I prefer my people in government to be unmotivated, not ambitious.
Who has a robust background as uber ambitious. So talk a little bit about that challenge for women in politics.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think all the studies demonstrate that, you know, as soon as women in political office seek higher office, there are negative perceptions. But I think, you know, the unfortunate thing is that when we write about that, then we perpetuate that stereotype. And, you know, the same thing happened with Hillary Clinton. You know, she had the highest approval ratings ever as Secretary of State. But as soon as she ran for president, that was too much for people. So look, I can't control what people write about me, but my job, you know, here in the General Assembly, I have amazing colleagues that I work with. I try my best to lift up them and to lift up their incredible work and be a partner to them. And I hope that I can be a partner for them and an advocate for families and small businesses around the state, you know, as the next comptroller of Maryland. There's so much important work to do. I can't take time to respond to sort of criticisms like that because I just don't think they're based in.
Well, if you go too far up the tree, they'll mispronounce your first name, guaranteed.
I apologize for going down that rabbit hole.
No, but
I thought,
okay.
My goodness, I thought I read that and I thought, man, I thought we were by that. So obviously we're not. Hey, Brooke, before we jump to the controller's race and everything going on with that, give us an update. In terms of what's happening in the General Assembly, both big picture, a lot going on, and then things that you're really working on because you send out newsletters, you keep us all abreast of what's going on. So sort of fill us in.
Sure. We are very busy. You know, under the leadership of our great speaker, Speaker Adrienne Jones, who you know well, Don, I know, you know, we really hit the ground running. And certainly the Senate is the same under Senate President Bill Ferguson, my colleague in District 46. We hit the ground running. You know, usually we take a week or so to do briefings, but we jumped right into bill hearings and passing bills and having things on the floor. We overrode, you know, many of the governor's veto, including, of course, the veto of the Blueprint for Maryland's Future, the Kerwin Commission bill. You know, criminal justice reform is continuing here in the House. I know my colleague Luke Klippinger and Delegate Vanessa Atterbury are hard at work. And I'll say it doesn't always get the same spotlight, but juvenile justice reform is also very important. And I know that's an issue that they're working on as well. We passed the Relief Act 2 weeks ago. The governor signed it last week. $1.5 billion in a variety of different kinds of forms of relief, from utility arrearage relief to direct payments to people to an expansion of the earned income tax credit. We are now the most generous state in the country for the benefits that we provide under the earned income tax credit, which is the number one poverty fighting program that we have at our disposal. And today, on the floor of the House of Delegates, led by my colleague from Montgomery County, Julie Polakovich Carr, we will be defending expanding the earned income tax credit to all taxpayers. So right now, there's a group of taxpayers who use their ITIN numbers rather, or their ITINs rather than a Social Security number to pay their taxes, and they've never gotten any EITC, which is outrageous. Today we're going to expand vote, or tomorrow we're going to. Today it'll be on second reader, and tomorrow we will vote to expand the earned income tax credit to all ITIN holders who file taxes as well. And we'll be the third state in the country to do that. So that's exciting. Unemployment assistance and reform we're working on. Voting to make sure all the expansion of voting rights that we had over the past year, that those stay in place. Housing, making sure that we can do what we can to support people so they aren't being evicted, but also to support our small landlords to make sure they aren't losing their houses because they need that rental income. And then on small businesses, just yesterday, I presented a bill in the Economic Matters Committee to support our small businesses with a capital access program to free up lenders to provide more capital to small businesses. So there's a lot going on.
Well, Nestor, because I'm going to jump back.
The big issue last time we were together was real concern that people were going to get evicted, right? So the pandemic has opened up Pandora's box for all of this. A year into this, and again, my wife and I walk 5.5 miles, you know, through East Bowl, through your district. By and large, I don't feel like people are living on the streets in the way that maybe we were afraid of. Can you update me on sort of where that's been in the last 6-8 months since the last time we got together? That we've seemed to manage to hold this thing together. I don't, you know, Trump or Biden, local, state, you know, federal, where money, you know, PPP, all of these different things. It feels like to some degree we're holding on and we can get through this thing.
I would definitely say that it could be a lot worse, right? It could have been a lot worse than it is. Without the CARES Act, without the rental relief that's come through, I think we would have seen a crisis like none of us has ever seen in terms of people living on the streets and being evicted from their homes.
To that end, government has
So government, I think, you know, the federal government really stepped in, and certainly the last act that was passed in December is incredibly important. But look, the reason that we don't have more people who are being evicted right now is because government stepped in and said, you can't evict people. But at the same time, that's not enough, right? Landlords need to be paid, you know, so their mortgages aren't foreclosed on, even though there is some foreclosure prevention in place right now, which means rental relief, right? We need to support the entire system. That means money going in to support residents who are paying rent to help the landlords who are paying for their mortgages, right? So, and that system, you know, while we in the state of Maryland just haven't put as much money into that program as other states have, so we're very interested in seeing, and the Relief Act, in fact, had more money for rental housing support, because we need more rental housing support. And now, but there are also long-term and systemic challenges with our housing system in Maryland, in terms of when you can file for eviction, to file to evict people without any notice to them. You know, the eviction filing fees, our attorney general is working on legislation to help fund that, and making sure that people who are looking at who might be evicted have access to counsel, have access to somebody who knows their rights and help be an advocate for them in court.
Well, if they can't afford their rent, they can't afford anything else, right?
Right. Well, yes, exactly. So there are a lot of, and it's, you know, it's so much better, not just for that family and for those folks to stay, to be able to stay in their house. It's better for society. It's better for all of us. You know, when you have a child who's moving all the time and then has to change schools every few months because they're moving from place to place, that's bad for the school system. It's bad for the child. It's bad for all of us because they're not learning. So housing stability and getting to a place where we're supporting families in a way that they can be housing stable, it's so important for our economy and for the potential of those families and our communities.
And Brooke, I didn't want to jump over while we're talking about stability and housing and preserving neighborhoods. I did not want to jump over the extending the earned income tax credit to those with the, is it ITN number? Is that what it's?
ITN
number. And those are folks, and because I get, you know, some of my friends yell at me all the time about these issues. Those are folks who are undocumented, correct?
So some of them are. Many ITIN holders who file taxes are undocumented, but many of them are not. Some of them are green card holders who are here legally and working legally, but just, you know, don't have a social security number. And so, but they pay taxes. And so they're filing their tax forms. And so they're doing it with an ITIN. But yes, many of them are undocumented. And, you know, there's this myth, I think, out there that undocumented immigrants don't pay taxes. And I want to do anything I can to rebut that. And certainly if I'm elected comptroller, I want to make sure that it's very clear how many, that our undocumented immigrants do pay taxes, and not just the sales taxes when they go buy things. They also pay property taxes, and they file, you know, they pay taxes because they're employees or they're contractors and they file their 1099s. So they are paying taxes, but right now they are not, even though they're income eligible, they are not getting the EIDs. That could be so helpful to keep them afloat and keep their families afloat.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are with the delegate from the 46th District in Baltimore City, candidate for controller, Brooke Learman. Brooke, in the time we have left, let's take a quick look at this controller's race. I always say, first of all, start by telling folks, in your mind, there were a lot of offices you could have run for, other things you could have done. You could have stayed where you were. What is it about? Tell people what the controller does, what the comptroller should do, and why you want this job.
So the Maryland comptroller, it's a really exciting job because it is uniquely positioned to make a difference on income-based issues for Maryland families, communities, and small businesses. I mean, that means, you know, we have the chance as the next comptroller in a post-pandemic Maryland to really be a champion for small businesses as they start to recover, for our families, and for our communities around the state. You know, so many families, communities, and small businesses over the years have been left behind. And I want to make sure that we have a champion in the comptroller's office who's looking out for each of them, you know, where they are. So reactivating our 12 comptroller offices around the state of Maryland and making them hubs of financial literacy classes, tax prep classes, really financial first responders to families and small businesses in crisis. No, I want to make sure that we're working with families and communities and small businesses around the state to lift them up so that they can succeed in the long run and not just on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, I measure the success of Maryland's economy on how well our families and small businesses are doing, and they're struggling right now. And so in a post-pandemic Maryland, I'm really excited at the chance to be their champion from the comptroller's office.
Has Peter Franchot done a good job?
Yeah. I mean, look, Peter, Comptroller Franchot, I think especially right now, is doing an exceptional work at getting relief out to families, getting relief out to small businesses. The people who he has in the comptroller's office are doing phenomenal, like really yeoman's work at trying to meet the needs of people where they are and to help our small businesses access the relief they need. And I really want to build on the work that he's done. You know, the comptroller's office can do so much to make life better and more equitable for Maryland families by helping small and family-owned businesses start here and stay here, you know, closing the racial wealth gap that exists in the state, and using, right, the Board of Public Works, our, you know, from our pension system and from the comptroller's office itself, you know, and the tax collector side of things, to really reinvigorate our economy and make sure that it's working and benefiting all families and all small businesses and not just a few.
I've had a spate in my life last 5 years of a whole bunch of people getting to be Don Mohler's age and deciding to retire, you know, off to Florida or someplace where estate taxes, leaving good citizens who've made a life here saying, I'm going to sell off the ranch. You can't die and you know, have the state of Maryland take all of my kids' money. How do you respond to that?
Sure. You know, I think people make different choices for different reasons. And, you know, some folks are done with the winter, no matter what the tax consequences of moving to Florida. I think it's a difficult equation. So we need to be looking at what we can do to make sure that seniors who want to stay here can afford to stay here. Certainly, you know, some of our pension benefits are untaxed right now, but not all of them. Are there other ways that we can be making sure that seniors feel welcome in Maryland? I know that some seniors wish that we had better public transit or better options because they can't drive, right? Some folks have decided to stop driving. Some folks are ready to give up their big yards and move into the city, Don, because they're stumbling, right? And they want, I know, but for those folks, the property taxes in Baltimore City might be too high. And so they think, I'll move to some other urban area in a different state. But I think, you know, it's important to make sure you look at the whole package and not just one form of taxes. It's what's being offered in the state as well. So, but I do think it's a conversation that we have to be clear about. I've started convening a number of seniors to start talking about what is it that we need to do to make sure that seniors can retire in dignity and live and have fulfilling lives after they decide, after they've retired.
Hey, Brooke, you mentioned there, and I think sometimes this doesn't get discussed much when we take a look at the comptroller. You mentioned pensions, and the comptroller actually plays a pretty key role, I think, in oversight, right, of the state
on the board. Pension, yes.
It's on the pension board. What issues have you identified already at this early stage in terms of the Maryland Pension Fund? One of the things I read about from time to time is the Maryland Pension Fund really has underperformed, and that we need to look at how we're investing and what we're investing in. I know that's a complicated, probably a show unto itself, but can you give us just a short overview of that issue?
Sure. You know, it's funny, when I was knocking doors in 2014, I wasn't thinking, oh my God, I'm so excited to work on pensions. But I've worked on the Joint Committee on Pensions now for 6 years, and I love it. And it's such an important and underutilized tool, I think, for Marylanders. So our pension fund serves nearly 415,000 retirees. And, you know, the sustainability of that pension system has to be a top priority for anybody running for office. And it certainly is for me. We put many reforms into place in 2011 to make sure that we're reaching our goal of full funding by 2039. And we're well on our way. We're aiming towards 80%. But look, I think there's a lot more we can be doing. First and foremost, climate change is a reality, right? And it has to be taken into account when we're looking at our financial forecasts as well. Other states have begun to commit to move their funds to be carbon neutral by divesting from fossil fuel companies if those companies can't come up with legitimate plans to align with the Paris Climate Accords. Recently, the New York Comptroller committed to divesting all of its funds from fossil fuel by 2040. And we need to be doing the same, because that's not just the right thing to do in line with our values, but it's fiscally responsible. And as a fiduciary, we have to be doing work like that.
We also have Washington on that side of it now too, right?
Yeah, exactly. We have Washington on our side. You know, we have to be doing more to look out for our pension funds, increasing transparency and diversity. You know, one of my concerns is that our investment managers do not reflect the diversity of our state. So we need to be making sure that we build on the Terra Maria program that exists in our pension system, to have more Black and women and people of color investment managers, because we know that when we diversify, we do better and our pension is safer. So there's a lot that we can do from our pension with our pension fund that I'm really excited about digging in on.
Well, it's a big, big job. And of course, right in the middle of it, in addition to pension management and other issues that always relate to alcohol control, it used to be, it's not now, all that stuff.
Not now.
But right in the middle of it is this thing called the Board of Public Works. And every now and then people hear about it or they see it. And the controller is one of only three people on there. Yeah. Tell our listeners why they should care about the Board of Public Works and what you envision your role on that board.
Sure. So the Board of Public Works is the most important state body that nobody's ever heard of, right? And it is three people, the governor, the treasurer, and the comptroller. And the Board of Public Works is tasked in Maryland. There's no other board like it in the rest of the country in state government. The board is tasked with approving contracts that are more than $200,000 and other items like wetlands licenses. It signs off on a variety of things. And many people don't know this, the Board of Public Works is tasked with helping to promulgate regulations around procurement. So it's incredibly interesting and important to everyday Marylanders. In fact, I've started putting together a graphic called the BPW brief, the Board of Public Works brief. I just posted one yesterday on my Facebook page, and I put it up on Twitter and Instagram. That says, here are highlights of what the BPW did today, because they meet every 2 weeks to approve or reject contracts. But, you know, look, the procurement process is just critical to how Maryland's government works for its residents. We could do a whole show on reforming procurement and making sure that we are, you know, streamlining the bidding process, encouraging state spending with, firms that are owned by people of color, making sure we're not doing waivers on MBE contracts, looking at cooperative bidding, making sure we have a way for small businesses to break into state contracting, perhaps through a revolving like mobilization fund. So there's so much we could be doing, but from the Board of Public Works, my goal will be to look out for families and small businesses, right? I will be their voice on the Board of Public Works, making sure that we're using our tax dollars in a way that is working for the most people in Maryland, keeping our tax dollars as much as we can local, and also looking out at the environmental and labor consequences of decisions that we make from the Board of Public Works. So there's a lot to be done on the Board of Public Works. I'm excited about it. As you know, I was on the Appropriations Committee for 5 years, and we'd appropriate money, and then I'd watch whether the Board of Public Works okayed things or not. So it's really where the rubber hits the road.
Brooke, I tell you what, as we were walking from Highland down Foster, we walked through the park, we saw the ducks in the pond, we turned down the corner by the sipping, but we did the whole East Side tour.
Nice.
I appreciate all the work you're doing, and we love the city, and good luck to you moving forward. I must say, that Springsteen thing behind you, I had to look the set list up. Don, you'll appreciate this, because Springsteen played two shows a night during that bottom line run behind Brooke's shoulder there.
Brooke, how many times, Brooke, you're not even going to be in the running here, I guarantee you. How many times have you seen Bruce?
So I've only seen him three times.
You're minor. I'm going to have Nestor. Go ahead.
I saw him do an acoustic solo show, Somerville Theater in Boston, Massachusetts, in front of an audience of 300. So I feel like that counts for more than just a normal show.
He called me a dummy once in a press conference, and Google me and Nils Lofgren, and you'll go listen for hours to old Bruce stories.
I think Nestor has seen Bruce 3,457.
How about this? I'll say this, and I haven't said this out loud yet because I don't want to do all this. Bruce has been in the news. The last time Bruce was on stage with E Street was in Auckland, New Zealand, and we waved goodnight to Thunder Road on the way out, and I thought, man, they got to get back on a stage. That's the most important thing, is that we need to gather with Bruce in the stadium environment after the shot and have a night.
I mean, our arts community, I will say, you know, this goes, I have two arts, you know, two concert posters. I went to school, Texas. I went to law school in Austin. So I got to see a lot of concerts, but I mean, our arts community is so important, and they're one of the communities that's hurting the most right now in Maryland. And so we have to make sure that we're supporting them, because there's something special, right, about people coming together, whether it's to view a piece of artwork or to see a stage production or see music. It's a really important part of lifting up our...
Gina Caruso went through all of that with us as I walked past the pack.
Brooke, I hope you'll become a regular and jump back on periodically just to update us about the General Assembly and let us know how the campaign is taking place. Again, Brooke Learman, delegate from the 46th Comptroller candidate in the state of Maryland. Nestor, take us out of here.
And I'll say this. Go listen to the new Bruce album. I started listening to it last week. Give it a little chance. Letters to you, all right? I got to check out the movie, too. But and the Obama Springsteen thing.
That's what I was going to say. This new Spotify series with President Obama. I mean,
I said to my wife, if we don't want to sit down and have a bottle of wine with Bruce and Barack one night, you know, we got to do that. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller, thanks to Brooke Learman, who's running for controller and running things out in the 46th and down in Annapolis. And obviously 30 minutes in, keeping us abreast of everything that's going on in the middle of this pandemic. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore positive.